Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Hello from the Heartland. My name is Jenna, and this is Smarter News. News when it matters and why it matters. Our Smarter series features unique people who help us think and live smarter.
Today, we're back with Dr. Michael Perry, Chair of Infectious Diseases at Stamford Hospital in Connecticut. And as his title suggests, infectious diseases are his specialty and have been for the last 40 years. We wanted to follow up with him to see what he's learned as a physician about COVID-19, but we also covered some key topics I'm certain we all have questions about. How is he applying social distancing to his own private life? And what is he telling his family? About an hour after our conversation, the U.S. government announced they are expanding priority testing to include those 65 and older with nearly no fever. This is important. Listen to what Dr. Perry says about the symptoms he's seeing on a local level and share that with your family and friends. Just something to note, you'll hear him mention Quest and LabCorp. These are private laboratories now able to process COVID-19 tests. This is new. When we last talked, this wasn't the case. In fact, when we last spoke, Dr. Perry hadn't had a COVID-19 case at his hospital. But that also changed. Local reports said a woman in her 60s who recently traveled to Italy, upon returning home, came almost immediately to the hospital and tested positive for the new coronavirus. I had about 101 questions on this particular case, but I had to limit those questions somewhat because of Dr. Perry's position and, of course, patient privacy. But that's where we started our conversation. First things first, we saw some news reports that your hospital saw a case of the new coronavirus. What can you tell us about that case?
Well, that was a case that we saw a couple of weeks ago related to travel, international travel. And as this pandemic has progressed, we realize that there's a lot of local spread, which is, of course, responsible for the pandemic. But travel internationally is still important. There are high-risk countries that we know of and that are certainly documented and published by the CDC, like China initially, now South Korea, Italy, Iran, Japan. Those are countries where there's a lot of local spread, and so there's concerns about travel, obviously, coming in from those countries. Our patient had traveled in Italy, where, as we know, there's a huge problem with the number of patients. Probably acquired that infection there and then came here, presented to our hospital with clear signs of that she had infection, and we tested her for coronavirus and it was positive.
How easy was it to test her for the virus? Because we've heard so many different varying reports about whether or not that test is accessible and what it's like for patients and doctors.
Right. That testing initially was available through the CDC, and that was at the end of January. It took about 3 to 4 weeks before the states then got their kits to do testing. We had sent for that patient and many of our other recent patients samples to the state. The state had limited capacity, so it was difficult to get those tests done on occasion. And the turnaround time, because of the number of requests and the limited number of cases that could be run, turnaround time was 2 to 3 to 4 days. But that was better than sending it to the CDC, because that was transmitting the sample to Atlanta. That took longer. Now that Quest and LabCorp have been approved to do the test, we are sending most of our outpatients to one of those laboratories, but our inpatients who are more severely ill go to the state. And now the turnaround time at the state level is only about a day.
Do you have a series of patients coming in on a regular basis that you'd like to test for COVID-19?
Well, we did, but I think now we can pretty well accommodate all of the patients that come in and request or need to be tested, because we can send them out to a commercial lab, or if they're admitted, we can send them to the state lab. And so we have other venues with which to satisfy the demand.
And I know it's different state to state, city to city, but on average, how many people do you think are coming to your hospital that you'd like to test for COVID-19? Is it dozens? Is it 100?
No, it's not. Fortunately, it's not at that level, although, you know, I don't know where we'll be a week from now or a month from now. But right now we're testing maybe 10 a day, based upon their presentation to the hospital with symptoms. We're not testing people who have no symptoms.
What clinically, when you're talking to your doctors, are you seeing as far as symptoms that would make you want to test someone for the coronavirus? And if you are testing them for the new coronavirus, are you also testing them for influenza, for example? Or is there something that's distinct that makes you think, this person I definitely would like to test for COVID-19?
Well, Jenna, that's an interesting question, because we are told that the primary manifestations of coronavirus infection are fever and cough. But we've seen a number of patients who have no fever, who have no cough, but have other symptoms like chest pain, maybe just shortness of breath without fever. And in the process of evaluating those patients, the CAT scan or the chest X-ray shows these hazy, what we call ground glass infiltrates, which makes you think this is a viral pneumonia, even though their presentation was atypical. And so we've tested a number of those patients as well, with atypical presentations, but with radiographic findings which suggest that this is viral pneumonia. And today, of course, the main concern with viral pneumonia is this is COVID-19, but we can see that with influenza. We can see viral pneumonia with other viruses as well, not just COVID-19 or influenza.
So of those patients that you've seen that sort of unusual presentation, have they tested positive for COVID-19?
Not yet. But they certainly are suspicious, and they certainly, I think, fit a broader definition of this condition.
So since the last time that we spoke, what does that tell you? What does that teach you about COVID-19 that remains a little bit of a mysterious virus?
Well, we obviously are concerned about testing everybody that needs to be tested. If we see patients who come in without a fever and they really have COVID-19, we don't want to miss those. So we probably need to broaden our testing base. And in fact, the CDC has broadened its requirements so that there's a discretionary group of patients that if we are concerned because of X-ray findings or chest presentations or maybe low oxygen levels, we can test those people even though they don't fit the classic presentation. And now having the commercial tests available, we don't have to stick to that rigid definition anymore, which I think is appropriate.
So the announcements over the last few days have widen the testing criteria. I mean, given you more bandwidth to test more people. And then we've heard about these private laboratories being able to process tests, and also a plan coming from the White House working with retailers to do drive-through testing, hopefully sometime soon. And we expect to get a plan. Maybe by the time our listener hears this, there is a plan in place. Do you feel like there are enough tests available and testing sites to start really gathering the data that we need, or are you concerned?
Well, I think we're on the cusp of that. For example, we are going to start doing a drive-up testing program tomorrow. There are a couple of sites in our county where there are drive-through testing sites. So those tests being made available to the general public, usually with a physician order, at least ours will be requiring a physician order, stressing that, you know, you should send patients with symptoms, not with no symptoms. But clearly, a number of those patients will be tested who are not symptomatic. And I think that will also provide some useful information about the general public, how many people who are asymptomatic actually test positive versus how many people test positive with mild or more severe symptoms.
At this point, what are you telling your family, Dr. Perry, about this virus? I'm sure you're getting a ton of phone calls, including mine, asking you about what how to feel at this point regarding COVID-19. What are you telling them?
Well, you're right about those phone calls, and you're right about the concern that's there. And it's not diminished by the press, of course. And there's a lot of anxiety that is out of proportion to the reality. Nevertheless, I think this is a serious problem. This is a bad virus, particularly if you're over age 70, as unfortunately I am. So I'm telling my family that a social distancing is important. It's not, it doesn't need to be carried to ridiculous extremes, but this is a virus that's spread through contact and through droplets. So some distancing from other people is important. Hand hygiene is very important. Overall, cleanliness and respiratory etiquette is important, and I think you do the best you can. Keep your fingers crossed and realize that if you do wash your hands well, you keep your hands away from your nose and your mouth, you cover your cough, and you get other people to do the same thing, you should be able to get through this without getting infected until such time as we have a vaccine or some effective antiviral drug.
So in a practical matter, are you asking your family not to come and visit, for example, for dinner? Are you avoiding a grocery store or a coffee shop or going out to eat? A lot of our audience just has some really practical questions about how to apply this precisely to their life. And I know it depends differently on, you know, where you are in the country. Washington State might be different than Texas, different than Connecticut. But what about those sort of daily activities? How are you applying social distancing?
Well, to try and operationalize this, you know, what we're doing in the hospital is if you are well and have no fever, no symptoms, and no definite contact, then you can come to work and you need to be monitoring yourself on a daily basis. In those situations, in a social setting, I think you're fairly safe. And so we would not want to keep our family away as long as everybody is healthy, has no symptoms, no cough, no sore throat and has not been in contact with anybody else who has coronavirus. That is a pretty good way to live at this point, realizing that you don't know everybody who's infected, you know, certainly outside the family circle. So I went to the grocery store yesterday, and let me tell you, there was a lot of non-distancing with crowds of people elbow to elbow in the checkout line, certainly not 6 feet away. So that's a risky environment. At the hospital, at least we have screening posters. We have scripting for the front desk so that people who are sick don't come, restricted visiting. And that makes the hospital at some times, I think, a safer place than the community.
That's interesting. Just thinking of the grocery store, that's certainly our experience here as well, about the crowds of people, more so than you'd ever experience at the grocery store. And it seems that if 6 feet really is the distance we want to keep, then going out to eat or going to church, for example, would be some activities to maybe just step back from for the time being.
Yeah, or if you go to church, you know, make sure you sit in a pew where you're well-spaced. Our town has decreed that all restaurants can only seat half of their cap that's made by the fire department, which hopefully then creates some more social distancing. And I think that's why, you know, sporting events are closed, Broadway is closed. It's to achieve some social distancing, but you need to be rational about it, you know. I think it's fine to go outside and walk around the park and go for a walk, go for a stroll. That's fine. Being outside is healthy and the air dilutes whatever viruses that might be coughed or breathed out by the folks that are out there.
Let's talk a little bit about the 14-day period that we keep on hearing so much about. When people are being quarantined, they're being quarantined for 14 days. Is that 14 days rather arbitrary, or is there great science behind the 14 days? Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, there's good science behind it. It's designed to quarantine people who've been exposed for the expected maximum incubation period. In other words, if I'm exposed today to somebody with coronavirus, and I'm quarantined for 14 days, the expectation is that if I am going to get sick, I will get sick within that 14-day period. And if I make it to day 14, I'm not going to get sick. And that's pretty reliable. There might be a few people that would take longer than that, but most, the vast majority of people who are exposed will get sick within that 14-day period.
What more have we learned, or do we have more to learn about whether or not someone with no symptoms can spread this virus?
We have more to learn about that. And I don't know the answer to that question. You know, how prevalent is asymptomatic disease? If asymptomatic time is a source of infection, is it 12 hours before you get sick? Is it 24 hours before you get sick? Or is it an insignificant number of patients so that you can just concentrate on the symptomatic period for significant amount of transmission? I think we don't know the answer to those questions yet.
I was looking at the case of the very first person that was the confirmed case of COVID-19 in America. He was a 35-year-old man. He was visiting family in Wuhan, China. He comes back to Washington State, and he's hearing about what at the time was called the Wuhan coronavirus. So he decides to go to a clinic because he's not feeling well. And then that is, again, the first confirmed case in the country. I was looking at the write-up on it in the New England Journal of Medicine, and I was having trouble really understanding how severe his illness was, because many of us heard this young man was sick. He recovered. But I did read that he was on oxygen. And I was just wondering, based on your knowledge of this case, you know, is the picture that we're presenting to the public that a 30-year-old, 40-year-old will do just fine in this illness matching up with this case of a 35-year-old that was in the hospital for a period of time?
I think the patient, the 35-year-old, had a more serious case than we would expect on average for that age. Most patients at that age would not require hospitalization, would have more of a standard flu-like illness, would recover after a week or so, and would not require hospitalization. So this was a little bit more severe because the patient needed oxygen, had abnormalities on chest X-ray, and required a lot of supplemental care to get through a hospitalization, which I think was around 8 or 9 days, if I remember correctly.
Well, and that's been difficult to understand. The CDC and the World Health Organization keeps on saying that, you know, 20% of the cases are serious cases, but I haven't been able to reach them to get a really good definition of what serious is. You know, what constitutes a serious case? Does that mean you're in the hospital for 2 weeks? Does that mean you have permanent damage to your lungs from a viral pneumonia? What does serious mean from what your understanding is?
Yeah, my understanding is that most of these serious cases require critical care. They require blood pressure medicines, higher levels of oxygen. Many of them may need to be intubated and on a ventilator for a while. Those are more serious cases. Mild cases might be in a regular hospital bed just because they need oxygen. But other than that, you know, the reasons for admitting a pneumonia are because the lungs aren't working well enough and oxygen and other medications are needed to support the breathing and the blood pressure. That's the reason to hospitalize these patients. And I might say that most patients with viral pneumonia recover without permanent damage to the lungs.
So is this a viral pneumonia that's coming on so let's say I was diagnosed with COVID-19, then I would also be diagnosed with viral pneumonia, or is it one and the same? COVID-19 brings on a condition very much like pneumonia?
Well, strictly speaking, the term COVID-19 is to apply to the disease, which would be the viral infection with or without pneumonia. Pneumonia is probably present even in people who are mildly ill, but is very subtle and may not be seen on a chest x-ray. The virus itself is called SARS-CoV-2, but that's a mouthful. So COVID-19 is easier to say, but that actually applies to the disease, not the virus itself.
So how is something so little so powerful, Dr. Perry? How is it that this little tiny virus is causing such severe illnesses in some cases that seem to come on so quickly, or that the illness takes a turn so quickly? Because that's something else that we're hearing, that someone can be sick. They feel, just as we've described, the body aches and a cough. And then suddenly, it almost seems within a matter of a few hours or a day, go from that to really needing to be in the hospital.
Yeah, there's this interesting characteristic there where patients get the infection, seem to be stable for a few days, and then suddenly deteriorate as a second phase of the illness begins. And I'm not quite sure that I know the explanation for that. I'm not really sure it's understood at this point. The other question you asked about, why is something so small capable of producing such severe disease? And of course, all viruses are small, whether it's influenza or smallpox or poliomyelitis. I mean, these are all viruses. They're all sub-microscopic particles, but they can produce deadly disease depending upon their makeup, their genetics, and the receptors with which they attach to the human body. So being small doesn't mean they're insignificant and inconsequential.
How did that patient that came to your hospital, how did they fare? How long were they in the hospital, and what is your understanding of their condition now?
They are doing well, and I believe that they've gone home, but I don't know that for a fact.
Got it. Where do you think we're all going to be on this come the first week of April?
I don't think we're going to be any better. In fact, I'm guessing that by the first week of April, things will be worse. In fact, the projections are that this can go for another 4 to 6 months. Hopefully that will reach a peak and then start to decline in a month or two, but that's no guarantee. We could certainly see this continue to escalate. And even though China seems to have plateaued, when the workforce in China starts to mobilize again and go back to work, is there going to be a second hump on that curve? Because now people are socially engaged and the virus has another opportunity to escalate. Again, those are questions we don't know the answer to, but certainly there's concern about that.
So as someone that has grandchildren that are out of school now, would you expect that parents should consider that their children may not go back to school after spring break or after this two-week break period, and that we're going to be in this sort of posture for a while longer?
Absolutely. I think that's going to happen. So I think you say we're going to close the schools and until further notice, and we'll decide when they can reopen after such time as we've reached a plateau or a balance in the number of new cases. It's also important to know that closing schools isn't the answer necessarily, because children don't seem to get sick with this virus. To what extent they get infected, are asymptomatic, but transmit the virus is not clear. But certainly children are a very, very small proportion of the illnesses with COVID-19. And when they do get it, they are not very sick.
Why is that? I mean, what is even the question to ask regarding that?
That's a good question, and I don't have an answer to that.
I mean, it's such a relief as a parent. I mean, there's so many million and one things to worry about on a regular basis when it comes to your children, but that has been a little bit of a relief to know that that's not necessarily the population that's the most targeted. I asked you last time about, what What was sort of that one thing that you were looking for that you would be really curious to learn about? And you mentioned super spreaders, and you described them as someone that instead of one person being able to infect a few, that maybe one person can infect up to 100. I'm sure that's something you'd still like an answer to. Have you found an answer to that or seen indications of that? And what is the question that you're now looking into as you watch the story evolve? What is the next thing that you would really like to know about?
Well, I think we'd like to know about the asymptomatic carriage. You know, how many people out there are well clinically with no cough, no fever, but are actually carrying the virus and are a source of infection to others who will get sick. That's a question that I think we need to answer. We don't really know. We're operating under the principle that people who are symptomatic are the main source of this virus for others. And then we'd like to have that concept reinforced or at least clarified. So that's my biggest issue right now.
Quick, concise, nonpartisan, smarter news, a refuge from the storm. I'm Jenna. Thank you for choosing smarter.